Two of the men stepped forward and seized Janine's wrists. They dragged her away from the fire behind the tail section of the wreckage. The other comrades laid down their rifles and followed them. They were laughing and bickering quietly over the order of preference and beginning to loosen their clothing. At first the screams from the darkness were so shrill and harrowing that Tungata turned away and squatted over the fire, feeding it with twigs to distract himself. But very soon there were no more screams, only the soft sound of sobbing and the occasional sharper cry immediately muffled. It went on for a long time, and Tungata's early disquiet was submerged and controlled. There was no passion or lust in this thing. It was an act of violence, of extreme provocation to a deadly enemy, an act of war without guilt or compassion, and Tungata was a warrior. One by one his men came back to the fire, adjusting their clothing. Strangely, they were subdued and stony-faced. "Is it over?" Tungata looked up, and one of them stirred and half rose, looking inquiringly at Tungata. Tungata nodded. "Be quick, then," he said. "It is only 7 hours to fast light." Not all of them went back behind the wreckage, but when they were ready to move out, Tungata did so. Ballantyne's woman's naked white body was curled in the fetal position. She had chewed her lips until they were raw meat, and she blubbered softly and monotonously through them. Tungata squatted beside her and took her face in his hands and twisted it up until he could look into her eyes. He shone his flashlight into them. They were the eyes of a wounded and terrified animal. Perhaps she had already crossed over the line between sanity and madness. He could not be certain, so he spoke slowly as though to a retarded child.
"Tell them my name is Tungata Zebiwe, the seeker after what has been stolen, the seeker after justice, after vengeance," he said, and he stood up.
She tried to roll away from him, but pain stopped her, and as she covered her groin with both hands, he saw the thin spurt of fresh blood from between her fingers. He turned from her and picked up her stained yellow skirt from where it had been tossed over a bush. As he strode back to the fire, he stuffed the skirt into his pocket. "Lungile," he said. "All right, it is done. Move out." At midnight, the pilot yelled across at Roland Ballantyne. "We're almost out of fuel. We must go back. They've got a tanker waiting for us on the apron." For a few moments, Roland did not seem to understand. In the greenish reflection of the instrument panel, his face was expressionless, but his mouth was a thin, cruel slash, and his eyes were terrible. "Go quickly," he said, "and get back here quickly." On the tarmac, the scout's own doctor, Paul Henderson, was waiting to take over from the GP that Roland had picked up at the Victoria Falls. Once he was aboard, Roland led Sergeant Major Gondile a little apart from the other troopers. "If only we could know which way the bastards were headed," he murmured. "Are they going south, or are they heading back for the river? Are they going to try the drifts, and if so, which one?" Esau Gondela recognized in him the need to talk, to say something merely to take his mind off the horror of what awaited them out there in the dark forest. "We won't be able to follow them with the bird," he said. "The forest is too thick. They would hear us from 5 miles and disappear."
"We can't follow with the chopper," Roland agreed. "They've got a SAM-7 with them. They would chop us out of the sky. The helicopter would be suicide. Only way is to cut their spoor and go after them on foot."
"They will have a night start, a full night." Esau Gondela shook the great black cannonball of his head doubtfully.
"The cat cannot resist mauling the dead bird," Roland said. "Perhaps they have not yet started to run. Perhaps they are drunk with blood. Perhaps we can still take them."
"Ready to go," the pilot shouted, as the fuel tanker started up and backed away from the Super Freelon. And they ran back to the open port in the fuselage and scrambled aboard. The helicopter lifted swiftly, not wasting time in climbing, and roared away low over the dark bush. At 10 minutes to 5 o'clock the following morning,
long before the sun had pushed up above the horizon, but when the light was already strong enough to make out shapes and colours, Roland slapped the pilot's shoulder and pointed to port. The pilot banked the Super Freelon sharply in that direction. It was a broken branch. The underside of the leaves were lighter in colour than those around it. It had been a flag to catch Roland's eye. Then there was another fleck of white, the raw stump of freshly broken branch sticking into the morning light. The pilot checked the Freelon, and they hovered 50 feet above it. They were staring down through the leafy canopy, and something white fluttered in the downdraft of the rotors. "Go down!" Roland shouted. And as they sank lower, suddenly it was all there, broken wreckage and the debris of the dead, blowing aimlessly about in the windstorm of the rotors. "There's a clearing," Roland pointed. And as the helicopter settled towards it, the scouts spilled out of her, jumping from 15 feet to the earth and immediately spreading out into the defensive perimeter. Then Roland deployed them into a line of skirmishers, and they went forward into the swath line in quick rushes, ready to meet enemy fire. Within minutes they had cleared the area. "Survivors," Roland snapped. "Search for survivors." They went back down the swath, and in the dawn light the carnage was horrific. Beside each corpse a scout paused briefly, but they were cold and stiff, and the men went on. Roland reached the nose section and glanced through the windshield. There was nothing to do for the crew until the long green plastic body bags arrived. He turned back, searching frantically, looking for a scrap of bright yellow, the colour of Jeanine's skirt.
"Colonel!"
There was a faint shout from the forest edge. Roland sprinted towards it. Sergeant Major Gondile was standing by the shattered tail section of the aircraft.
"What is it?"
Roland demanded harshly, and then saw her. Isor Gondela had covered Jeanine's naked body with a Blue Airways blanket from the wreck. She lay curled under it like a sleeping child with just her tousled head showing. Roland dropped on his knees and gently lifted the corner of the blanket. Her eyes were closed with swollen purple bruises, and her lips were raw chewed flesh. For seconds he did not recognize her, and when he did, he believed that she was dead. He laid his open palm upon her cheek, and the skin was moist and warm. She opened her eyes. There were mere slits in the abused flesh. She looked up at him, and the dull, lifeless eyes were more frightening than her torn and battered flesh. Then the eyes came alive with terror. Jeanine screamed, and there was the ring of madness in the sound.
"Darling!"
Roland caught her up in his arms. But she fought him wildly, still screaming. Her eyes were mad and staring. Fresh blood oozed from the cracked scabs on her lips.
"Doctor!" Roland yelled. "Here, on the double!"
And it took all his strength to hold her. She had thrown off the blanket, and naked she kicked and lashed out at him. Paul Henderson came at the run and tore open his pack. He filled a syringe and muttered, "Older still," as he swabbed her skin. He pressed in the needle and squeezed the clear contents of the syringe into her arm. She went on fighting and screaming for almost a minute, and then gradually quietened and relaxed. The doctor took her from Roland's arms and nodded to his assistant. The young medic orderly held up a blanket as a screen, and the doctor laid Jeanine on another. "Get out of here," he snapped at Roland, and began his examination. Roland picked up his rifle and stumbled to the tail section of the Viscount. He leaned against it, and his breathing was hoarse and ragged, but slowly it eased, and he pushed himself upright.
"Colonel, sir," Isor Gondela appeared beside him, "we have picked up their spoor, incoming and outgoing."
"How long ago?"
5 hours at the least, probably longer."
"Be ready to move out. We're going after them."
Roland turned away from him. He needed to be alone just a little longer. He was not yet entirely under control.
Two of the scouts came from the helicopter at a trot, carrying one of the yellow plastic body-moulded stretchers between them.
"Colonel,"
Paul Henderson tucked the blue blanket carefully around Jeanine's body, and then he and the orderly lifted her tenderly onto the yellow stretcher and tightened the straps to hold her. While the orderly prepared the plasma drip, the doctor led Roland a little aside. It's not very good news, he said softly.
What did they do to her?
Roland asked, and Paul Henderson told him. Roland gripped the stock of the rifle so hard that his arms began to shudder, and the muscle in his forearms stood out in ridges and hard knots.
She's bleeding internally, Henderson finished. I have to get her into theatre very quickly. A theatre can handle this type of surgery. In Bulawayo. Take the helicopter, Roland ordered brusquely. They ran with the stretcher to the Super Freelon, the orderly holding the drip bottle high.
Colonel, Henderson looked back. She's still conscious, if you want.
He did not finish. The little group waited for Roland beside the fuselage, not certain whether to load the stretcher aboard. With a strange reluctance, Roland walked heavily towards them. The enemy had used his woman. She was one thing that was sacred. How many of them? The thought made him check, and he had to force himself to go on to where she lay on the stretcher. He looked down at her. Only her face showed above the blanket. It was grotesquely swollen, and her mouth was a raw red ruin. Her once lustrous hair was stiff with filth and dried blood, but her eyes were clear. The drug had driven back the madness, and now she was looking up at him. Only the eyes were the same dark indigo blue. Painfully, her damaged lips framed a word, but no sound came. It was his name she was trying to say.
Roland. Roland.
And his revulsion rushed upon him. He could not hold it back. How many of them had taken her that way? A dozen? More? She had been his woman, but that had been destroyed. He tried to fight it, but he felt nauseated, and quick, cold sweat chilled his face. He tried to force himself to stoop over her, to kiss that terribly battered face, but he could not. He could not speak nor move, and slowly the light of recognition went out in her eyes. It was replaced by that dull, empty look he had seen before, and then she closed the livid, swollen lids over them and rolled her head slowly away from him.
Take good care of her, Roland muttered hoarsely,
and they lifted the stretcher into the helicopter. Paul Henderson turned to him, his face twisted with pity and helpless anger, and he laid his hand on Roland's arm.
Roly, it wasn't her fault, he said. If you say anything more, I might kill you.
Roland's voice was thickened and coarsened by disgust and hatred.
Paul Henderson turned from him and clambered into the machine. Roland made a wind-up signal to the pilot in the bubble windshield above him, and the big clumsy aircraft lifted noisily into the sky.
Sergeant Major, Roland called, take the spore. And he did not look back as the helicopter rose high into the pink dawn and then swung away southwards.
They went in deep formation, so that if they ran into an ambush, the tail could circle and outflank the attackers to free the head. They went at storming speed, much too fast for safety, going hard as marathon runners. Within the first hour, Roland had ordered his scouts to strip their packs. They abandoned everything but the radio set, their weapons and water bottles and first aid kits, and Roland pushed the pace still harder. He and Esau Gondele took turns at point, the one dropping back each hour as the other came forward. They lost the spoor twice in stony ground, but each time picked it up on the first cast ahead. It was running true and straight, and they had quickly made the number of the chase as 9 men. Within 2 hours, Roland knew each of them as individuals by the spoor they left behind them. The one with a nick in his left heel, flat foot, long one with a gap of over a metre in his stride, and each of the others with more subtle characteristics to differentiate them. He knew them, and he hungered for them.